This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The number one action we need to take is to prevent outbreaks from happening in countries where we've got the highest risk. And there are several where there isn't the ability to, or the health system in place to be able to rely on.
That's the senior technical advisor for measles and rubella at the World Health Organization on the increase in measles cases. Details coming up. Also, the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region is already having a growing regional impact. And in the past week, there has been a lot of activity as French forces kill Islamist militants in the Sahel. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region is less than 2 weeks old, but is already having a growing regional impact with effects felt in Sudan, Eritrea, and Somalia. Mohamed Yusuf has the latest from Nairobi.
Ethiopian government forces have captured the town of Alamata, 120 kilometers from the Tigray region's capital, Mekele, after nearly 2 weeks of fighting. Mustafa Ali is a Horn of Africa security expert. Despite the capture of Alamata, he says the federal government is facing a long conflict.
This tells you that Ethiopia is advancing and is going to capture more ground. But here is the challenge. This war might turn to become a major drawn-out guerrilla fighting that will be very hard for the Ethiopian soldiers to dislodge the TPLF.
Ethiopia's military attacked fighters loyal to the Tigray regional government this month after Tigrayan forces allegedly assaulted a military base. The war has already sent more than 20,000 civilians to flee to Sudan for safety, a sign of region's worsening humanitarian situation. The war escalated in recent days. Tigray's regional president, Debretsion Gebremichael, said his forces attacked Eritrea with missiles and warned there will be more attacks. Tigray accuses Eritrea of sending troops to attack them, an allegation denied by Eritrea. Ali says the involvement of Eritrea will strengthen the Ethiopian government's chances of winning the war.
The war is going to be more deadly and there will be a lot more refugees coming out of the conflict itself. The entry of Eritrea will give Abiy Ahmed an upper hand in that he will be able to use the Eritrean forces, their expertise and understanding of the terrain, basically, because all these are Tigrayans.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said Sunday his forces can handle the fighting and don't need assistance from another country. In recent days, the Ethiopian government has pulled some troops from Somalia to help quell the armed uprising. That move may have a negative impact on Somalia, says Comfort Ero, the Africa Program Director for the International Crisis Group.
This also sort of puts Somalia into jeopardy, especially as Somalia gets ready for presidential and parliamentary elections. And as you know, there is a very close relationship between Prime Minister Abiy and President Farmajo. The most worrying concern would be what this would do to Sudan, given its own very fragile stability at the moment, and then Somalia as it enters into election.
The Sub-Saharan Africa Intelligence Analyst for the Risk Advisory Group says the conflict will also stretch Ethiopia's internal security apparatus.
There's widespread bouts of internal violence going on across the Amhara region, across the Oromo region, and across the Somali and Southern People's regions. And the army is quite often having to deploy to contain that, in particular in situations where local security forces are unable to do so. The fact that the federal government is now involved in this conflict against the Tigray region is only going to stretch that capacity further and force Abiy to perhaps make some tough decisions about, you know, deployments in Somalia, whether that be for AMISOM or more broadly.
AMISOM is the African Union mission in Somalia. The United States, the United Nations and other world powers have called for a halt to the fighting and start of mediation efforts. so far to no avail, as the federal government has ruled out any talks with the regional leaders. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
There has been a lot of activity in the past week as French forces killed Islamist militants in the Sahel, including the elimination of the top military leader of Al-Qaeda's North Africa operations. International Edition's Laurie London gets an update from Paris-based reporter Catherine Field.
Early last week, French forces in the Sahel neutralized the operational head of GSIM. That's an anti-insurgent jihadist group, the group to support Islam and Muslims. It's Al-Qaeda affiliated, had a lot of connections really among the local communities, particularly in central Mali. The actual person who was neutralized was no longer operational on the ground, but he was training new recruits. And so that was where his power was, to be able to get new recruits in. Then we had later in the week, French forces apparently targeted 30 jihadists again in central Mali. So this comes at a time when there has been this increase in jihadist violence. There's been this whole idea that it seemed to have been slipping away from the French, the whole operation. So for them to have this second, what they're known as big fish, was important to them, because let's not forget, back in June, they neutralized the leader of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. And that was, again, a symbolic move, because it was the leader of that particular branch of the organization.
There's been a lot of consternation between Bamako and Paris regarding how to deal with these insurgencies, with France really digging in as far as their unwillingness to negotiate with these militants.
Indeed, Paris and Bamako are really very far apart on the issue of dialogue. Paris says only speak with groups who have agreed to renounce violence and who are working towards some sort of national unity. For their part, in Bamako, they've had these national conciliation conferences. They've got these accords from 2017 and 2019 that supports dialogue. So they say they do need to have a dialogue. And what really upset the French was in October, when the then transition government agreed to free 200 prisoners, 200 convicted jihadists, to release them in exchange for the former Mali prime minister to be released and a French aid worker. And that was then followed by film on social media of these 200 jihadists being welcomed back into the group, welcomed back into their armed groups again as fighters. So there is a lot of tension between Paris and Bamako at the moment. And it's difficult to see how in the short term, with the government and the regime that is in place in Mali, how this can be solved.
So what happens next as far as France's role there? What are you hearing from President Emmanuel Macron?
Emmanuel Macron will sometime in December review troop numbers in the Sahel. They are hoping to be able to withdraw a few forces and hoping that they will be replaced by other European forces, such as from Estonia or the Czech Republic. Let's not forget, it was just in January of this year that there was the big five Sahel leaders met in southwestern France, met with Emmanuel Macron, and they gave their undertaking that they supported completely what the French were doing in the Sahel. Now, since then, everything's changed a bit. Back in January, the focus was on the Islamic State and the Greater Sahel. That was really the danger. It's changed since then, and there are other groups who have come up. So there is this feeling that perhaps the French might try and pull out a few troops, because at the moment, yes, they have had these successes in the last couple of months, but they're still being a lot of troops have been lost. France has lost 50 troops since they moved into Mali in 2013. Plus, there's a lot of pressure here in France for French troops to withdraw and to be doing more of their duty here in France, where they are needed to patrol specific sites, really sensitive sites in the country, at a time when the country itself is on a security alert.
That was Paris-based reporter Catherine Field speaking with International Edition's Laurie London. A week of UN-led political talks in neighboring Tunisia reached an agreement to hold national elections on December 24th next year, without specifying whether these would be presidential or parliamentary or both. But the Supreme Presidential Council said having a new constitution should come first. The Tunisia talks were also meant to produce a temporary executive to govern in the interim, providing services to a country battered by economic challenges and the coronavirus pandemic, as well as the unresolved conflict. Wolfgang Paschtei, former Austrian military attaché to Libya, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the Libyan multi-track talks.
There is a fundamental problem with the Libya Political Dialogue Forum. It brought together 75 delegates selected by UNSMIL, not by the Libyans. And according to UNSMIL, they shall represent a broad range of the Libyan political landscape and the civilian society. But the key weakness, even if this may be true, is the selection process. With the exception of those from the HOR and the House of Representatives and the Supreme State Council, both bodies implemented by the Shkirat Agreement, all the delegates don't have any kind of national legitimation. And even those from the HOR and SSC were handpicked by interim UNSR Stephanie Williams. This is the key problem. Many in Libya's west, east and south have already spoken out against the process. So the way to provide legitimation to any outcome could be to ask the HOR and the Supreme State Council for endorsement. We'll see if this works. The current draft constitution is way too vague in several key areas to provide a solid foundation for the stabilization of Libya. It is not even clear how a referendum about it would look like. Would it require the majority of all the Libyans or the majority in each of the three historic regions to adopt? It could be argued, and it could well be true, that some want to have the new constitution first in order to delay the whole stabilization process. We need to be aware that there are many people, at least in the political entities, who make quite some profit from the current situation.
The Tunisia talks were also meant to produce a temporary executive to govern in the interim, providing services to a country battered by economic challenges and the coronavirus pandemic, as well as the unresolved conflict. Could the Libyan parties agree on a transitional government without fighting over portfolios?
No. Although there was in fact a debate about some kind of a technocrat government. And unfortunately, there were even quite concrete rumors about the attempted bribing of delegates to buy their votes by some people. And those who allegedly bribed or tried to bribe delegates included current officials. This will be investigated by UNSMIL. Some people claim that the key problem is still the ongoing interference in foreign presence in Libya by Turkey, Russia, Emirates, Qatar, and so on and so on. But I would say this is certainly not correct. The Libyans would continue to fight over portfolios even if all foreigners would be gone, because the underlying problems of Libya would not be solved. We need to be aware that the root causes of the current situation are not in Turkey or in Egypt, but they are that underlying problems are not addressed by a withdrawal of foreigners and are not addressed by any kind of current initiatives. And those underlying root causes are the century-old tribal conflicts, the leftover of the chaotic administration under Gaddafi, the discord between Libya's historic regions, the struggle for wealth, and the rising influence of the political Islam. And maybe most important, the numerous militias, especially in the greater Tripoli area, who are entirely out of state control. As long as those are not addressed, there won't be a real progress.
The political meetings came in parallel with military talks earlier in the week to fill in the details of an October ceasefire deal that formally ended fighting between forces backing rival administrations. Could the multi-track talks pave the way for a viable political solution in Libya?
This multi-track talk approach is certainly very positive, but unfortunately right now there is a lack of progress on all tracks. The military 5+5 talks in Sirte did not make much real progress. It agreed that all foreign mercenaries must leave Libya without defining who falls under this definition. They agreed about some procedures and the mechanism to open the coastal road very soon. That's a very good point. And they also agreed about the beginning of the withdrawal of heavy weapons from the Sirte area under the supervision of the 5+5. So that's certainly a progress. Regarding the LPDF, Stephanie Williams praised the outcome yesterday after the end of the talks and called the agreement on the date of elections, which is December 24 next year, historic. But I would say this election date is the only one real takeaway from Tunis. So even if there is an agreement during the next round of talks, the outcome could very well be like the Shkirat Agreement, from 2015, which had no legitimation within Libya and was rejected by many.
That was Wolfgang Paschtei, former Austrian military attaché to Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. The World Health Organization reports measles cases and deaths have soared around the globe since 2016. It reports an increase in cases to nearly 870,000 last year, while more than 207,000 people died, a 50% increase from 2016 levels. As Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, many of those becoming sick are children.
The World Health Organization reports a steady and steep decline in the number of children getting immunizations against this killer disease. The UN agency says the failure to inoculate children on time with two doses of measles vaccines is the main driver for increased cases and deaths. It says vaccination coverage remains well below the 95% needed to control the disease and prevent outbreaks and deaths. Added to this mix is the coronavirus pandemic. Although reported cases of measles are lower this year than last, WHO says efforts to control the coronavirus outbreak have resulted in disruptions in vaccination. WHO senior technical advisor for measles and rubella, Natasha Crowcroft, tells VOA different strategies are needed to prevent new measles outbreaks in the time of COVID-19, the disease brought on by the coronavirus.
The number one action we need to take is to prevent outbreaks from happening in countries where we've got the highest risk. And there are several where there isn't the ability or the health system in place to be able to rely on.
Prokof says countries where routine immunization for children was happening will recover quickly from delays or suspended coverage during this difficult period. She says weak countries will continue to be at risk of deadly outbreaks unless swift action is taken to close this widening gap. The WHO reports more than 94 million people are at risk of missing vaccines because nationwide campaigns have been put on pause in 26 countries. This led to huge outbreaks in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Madagascar. 8 of the 26 countries now have resumed their campaigns. They include Brazil, Central African Republic, Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Nepal, Nigeria, Philippines, and Somalia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A government inquiry is underway amid a public outcry after a church leader accused of various financial crimes fled South Africa after apparently bribing border officials. Self-proclaimed prophet Shepherd Bushiri has been granted bail and was expected to go on trial soon along with his wife Mary. Darren Taylor has the story.
On Saturday, Bushiri made a live appearance on his Facebook page after leaving South Africa 3 days earlier for the country of his birth, Malawi.
I am in Malawi, not running away from any trial in South Africa. If I wanted to run away, I couldn't have come to Malawi and I couldn't have announced that I'm in Malawi. Running away, you go in a country where you don't tell people where you are. I have come to seek for my government intervention.
The 37-year-old arrived in South Africa in 2015 to establish a Christian evangelical church he called the Enlightened Christian Gathering. Bushiri's charisma and outlandish, flashy style, including promises to cure disease and turn congregants into millionaires, all through God, of course, soon attracted many followers.
And according to our recent census, we have recorded about 7.8 million people who have registered online as members globally, and about 3.2 million people have registered as members in South Africa alone.
The young prophet's backstory is colorful indeed. Allegations against him include impregnating a Malawian teenager and paying her to have an abortion. When his child apparently bounced and the girl had the baby, Bushiri supposedly refused to pay support. Congregants also allege he promised mass massive returns on large investments with him, and they've yet to receive a cent back. Bushiri denies the allegations, suggesting they're from jealous, evil forces.
Being a young black person, having success, has attracted different attractions, and some of them are positive and some of them are negative.
In early 2019, the South African Priority Crisis Unit, known as the Hawks, arrested Bushiri and his wife. Investigators claim they've committed fraud and money laundering involving about $1.2 million. Bushiri says the charges are fabricated and revenge because he refused to pay bribes to senior police officers in 2017. He says he reported the attempted extortion to authorities, including South Africa's Independent Investigative Directorate, or IPID, but it didn't help. IPID spokesperson Ndileka Tala confirms the prophet did indeed file a complaint.
Our investigators were quite prepared to go and identify the suspect with him, but again, due to his business, he didn't avail himself, and as a result, we are still waiting for him to come back and give IPID information that is going to enable the directorate to ensure that there is no any sort of police misconduct.
Bushiri also maintains his wife felt forced to flee South Africa because they were convinced they'd soon be murdered there.
So many times I've had attempts of assassinations. I feel my life and my wife's life is not safe. I wouldn't want to die while my name is not cleared. In February this year, I almost got shot in Sandton at a filling station. The Sandton police, they are aware of this case. They even have a footage where my life was at a risk. I almost got shot. And until today, nothing has been done.
The police in Sandton, Johannesburg, were unable to confirm or deny Bushiri's claim. Government spokesperson Pumla Williams says the preacher must return to South Africa as soon as possible.
Whatever method that she has used to exit our shores, she has done it illegally. We've started the processes as early as Saturday to make sure that we remain within the legal framework of starting the process of extradition.
She says her government has excellent relations with its counterpart in Lilongwe, so she expects Bushiri's visit, as she puts it, to Malawi to be a short one. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on Continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. We have our producer, Mokwe Yabaro. Thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.